With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the Health Happens Podcast again. I'm Chris Pickerel, and joining me as always, the lovely Dr. Michael Frosina.
Did you call me lovely?
I did, yeah. I was just trying to throw you off. I'm trying to get inside your head right from the very beginning today, Mike.
Well, complimenting me is only going to increase my confidence.
No. See, the thing is with cognitive dissonance, it's hard to be difficult and like someone at the same time. So I'm just trying to soften you up. But you know what? Chris isn't such a bad guy, actually. He called me lovely tonight on the show.
I just consider that weakness.
You would, Mike. That's why I'm inside your head.
Yeah, so people might wonder why we're being like this today, and it's because we got a debate.
Debate night! Yeah. And I will say right from the beginning, I have the tougher side of the argument on this round.
And I'll agree with that.
Yes. So we are, as you probably already know from the title, we are talking about the role of evidence in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I am excited to do this debate. It will be harder for me to play this side of it because I think it's hard. I even looked up, trying to cheat a little bit. I was like, good arguments against evidence-based medicine. And there weren't any. There were not any really solid. I mean, I'm going to drop some good talking points and some good sound bites. But for the most part, and there's some bias in, who's writing articles about it, but it was very difficult to find out this will really beat them on this point here.
Yeah, I guess it depends how you frame the argument, and we'll get into the discussion a little more, and we'll talk about some of the pros and cons for sure.
Definitely. So, as you've probably already guessed, Mike is going to present the case for evidence in medicine, and I'm going to try to outfox him a little bit, not so much saying there shouldn't be a role for evidence in medicine. Perhaps, though, we need to reevaluate what that role is and what it means for us.
Okay,
no problem.
So, yeah, why don't you go ahead? You want to start?
No, I think it's probably better if you start this one, Mike.
Okay, I can start us off about the role of evidence in medical practice. And it's, I don't know that I have, a great intro to get into here. It's really just about talking about what is evidence and how do we bring that into our practices? How does it help guide decision-making process in practice when we're dealing with patients in front of us who have a certain concern or a certain condition? How do we decide how to proceed in treating these individuals? And that's where evidence comes in. And it really just comes down to knowing what is likely to work and what's not likely to work. Is there any basis behind the recommendations that we're making for a patient? That's what evidence is. Otherwise, what are we left with? We're just giving opinions, and why go to a doctor for an opinion, right? You want informed information. And where does that information come from? The informed part comes from the evidence. So that's where evidence-based medicine comes into play, is informing the decision-making process for all healthcare practitioners, informing the guidelines that help guide the decision-making process, and therefore providing some insurance that the recommendations are going to have a good chance of helping the client out.
I liked how many times you used the word informed in there.
Yeah, you kind of have to.
Especially when you said informed information.
Did I?
That was the best.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah, what are you going to do? No, I mean, really, my alternate approach to tonight's debate was going to be like, sink a few beers and just get belligerent on the show. listen, Mike, and your evidence, here's what I think of you. I'm going to prove you something right now.
Okay.
So
you didn't do that, though, right?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't do that. I was tempted. It's Friday night, and after I looked up a lot of stuff, I was just like, oh, boy, this could be a tough one. But everything you said there, I mean, there's no – what you just trotted out was like the old, weary, conservative line of – you know, like you're wearing a white coat and you're 100 years old and you're like, yeah, we have to do this by the evidence. That's fine. If that's the role you want to play, Mike.
You want me to let you go or should I just jump in and tell you how many ways you're wrong?
No, it's not that. It's not even that I'm wrong. It's what's a bigger challenge is to say, is that approach wrong? And I think that's what we want to get is, are there other approaches? Are there other things that we want to take into consideration? And how far do we take it? I don't know. How far do you want to take it tonight, Mike?
Let's take it all the way, Chris.
I knew that was going to be your answer. I was baiting you for trouble. Here's my best take. Here's my best counter argument. I've got a few, but here's my best counter argument. Evidence-informed, we will use the phrase evidence-informed medicine, which actually is a phrase I do personally like, but it can only take us so far, and here's the thing with a lot of research. It just doesn't translate into clinical practice. And we know this. We know this about research is that it has its limits, and it has its efficacy limits, and we don't always see in practice what we see in paper, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So what do you do with that? How do you handle that?
So, well, let me address a couple things first. The first thing I want to talk about is your assertion that I sound like a 100-year-old conservative type. And I do want to address that because nothing could be further from the truth when we're talking about evidence-based medicine. I mean, really, EBM only came into favor sometime in like the 80s or 90s. It's fairly new in medical practice as far as it being the standard for guiding clinical guidelines. So what was often driving guidelines before and still is to a large part today is, you know, committees that were being formed, and largely the recommendations were based on expert opinion, not necessarily best evidence.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that's where I just want to start off and say this, you know, that's not really the old approach. We're actually talking about the more modern, newer approach,
yeah,
okay?
No, it was really more of a personal attack than a counter-argument.
I know it was, but I just want to, address that first. Your second point is, okay, well, how do we take the research and translate that into clinical practice? And you're absolutely right that what we see in research doesn't always or even often equate to what we see in clinical practice. And there's very good reasons.
Here's where I want to insert one of my stronger points, though. So I'm happy that you concede that. Knowing that that has been conceded, why then do we let it so strongly dictate what we generate as best practices?
Because best practices are meant to be guidelines and they're meant to be general statements for, you know, averages, if you will, for the general population. And it's meant to be a guideline is meant to be used as part of the decision-making process in medicine, not as a firm directive, this is what you have to do for every single patient, but more of a, like I said, a guideline of this is what evidence suggests works best for most people. But that certainly doesn't exclude the patient-centered care, right? It's a component of patient-centered care. So that's how we integrate that. You have to take the research evidence and combine that with, you know, your personal experience and your clinical expertise and also patient values and other things, the cost of treatment and you know, the personal situation of every patient. So that's how you got to bring it into clinical practice. And that's why you go to a professional. You go to somebody who does have experience and knowledge to be able to integrate all those things together to give you the best possible care.
Mike, it's difficult to challenge a lot of what you said, because a lot of what you said in a lot of ways makes my argument for me a little bit, in that you're saying evidence-based medicine, or evidence, let's just say evidence or research, is actually...
Well, let's not equate evidence and research. Those are not the same thing. Research is one form of evidence.
Okay, well, what do you mean when you say evidence, then?
Well, evidence could be numerous things. It could be also be a clinical experience, right?
Are you sure that is a
form of evidence. 100% sure.
Is it? I don't think clinical experience counts in
clinical experience counts, and I'll tell you why. I know that is true, Chris, because we have in the journals, we have case reports, and we have opinions that are out there. Now, a single clinical experience on its own does not count as evidence. But once you take that clinical experience, if you've observed something and you put it out there for the community, for others to see, for others to digest and think about and debate, then it can become part of what we consider to be evidence. Okay,
yes.
So clinical observation and clinical experience is definitely part of that.
You're right. And then what you're doing is you're putting those in a ranked order. And this is, again, this is the classic model where we have RCTs, randomized controlled trials, as the best. And above that, we've got systematic reviews and what do you call them? Meta-analysis, right?
Yep.
And those are considered the highest evidence because they pool together a bunch of studies and they pool together studies of the highest quality. So that's what I'm talking about. Is that what we're talking about when we talk about evidence, Mike?
I think we're talking about all of it.
Okay.
Right? Not just the RCTs. We're talking about all the evidence that can be gathered.
Yes, but here's what I'm going to suggest happens in practice. So I think the theory you're laying out for us checks out, and I think that's good. But I think what happens in practice is we take often committees with very little practice experience, take these large research trials or meta-analysis or systematic reviews, and they draft guidelines for an entire profession that become the best practice guidelines. Now, I don't think those are fundamentally bad, but is a panel that is not necessarily the people who generated the research or clinically active practitioners, are they the best people to dictate best practices to the profession?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point for sure. And I think, again, it's not a... them dictating them.
I want to make a point on this one, because you say that and you're right in theory, but when best practice guidelines come out, those are the guidelines. And if you stray from those guidelines, you are now personally vulnerable, liable, responsible for justifying why you have strayed. Therefore, you're encouraged not to stray because there are risks.
You are right. There are risks. There are risks to straying too far from the guidelines, for ignoring the guidelines. I think they need to be considered in the decision-making process. And that's where the skill of the clinician comes in to decide how much weight do I put on each of the factors that comes to a clinical decision-making process. I think my point, and what I'm trying to get across today, and I don't want to stray too far from this, Chris, although you're trying very admirably too, is,
I warned you,
is that evidence-based medicine has to be part of that decision-making process.
Yes.
It should be part of that decision-making process. If it's not, that's dangerous.
I agree with that fully. And I think where I have my strongest ground to stand on simply is in the fact that it becomes dictate. It becomes best
practice. So this is what I was afraid of. I was afraid that this debate would just morph into more of a debate about how is evidence best used in practice, not just the merits of evidence-based medicine, right?
Mm-hmm.
To become that.
You're right, Mike, and I'll take some responsibility for that. I was kind of moving into a topic that was a little easier to debate than actual evidence-based medicine, but But I do think it's a relevant, I think it's a relevant piece of this discussion. You're right, it's not the core of this discussion, but I do believe it must be part of it in order for us to really fully hash it out. Here's, I'm going to break out one of my best parts now just because I want to like get a good punch in while I can.
Okay, go ahead.
Here's the thing, and this one I think I actually believe, even though, truthfully, I support the role of evidence in medicine, evidence-informed practice for sure, but here's something that I think is true. Research is no less biased than empiricism. It's only more rigorous in its bias.
Oh, I definitely disagree with that, Chris.
But let me ask you some questions now, just some like broad questions. Who publishes research? Who chooses what gets published? What motives lie behind what gets published? Who gets paid? What careers are at stake, or at least what's being involved in those careers? What probably evil has vested interests in the truth? Like there are a lot of reasons that things get published and not published. And
you're right.
And there's bias there for sure.
There can be bias. I mean, inherently, there are built-in methods to reduce, if not eliminate, bias from a well-designed study.
But those themselves are bias.
No, they're not.
Well, that's, I mean,
yes,
that's,
I mean, a double-blind crossover study virtually eliminates all bias.
You're right. You're right about that. A good RCT should eliminate bias in the research method and design. However, it doesn't eliminate the bias of the researchers that developed the study and chose what they wanted to study. And why did they do that? Are they career researchers who need to publish something? Are they academics who need to publish or perish? And therefore, did they choose something in the first place that already cut down the likelihood of other things being included in the evidence pool?
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you totally here and say that as long as a study is well designed, you can pretty much discount all the biases from it. Now, it's up to the peer reviewers then to take a look at the research methodology and look for sources of bias and determine whether or not that could have influenced the results. But again, I mean, that's not an inherent flaw.
No, not the results, not the methodology, but the choice of what to research in the first place. Saying there's money in this, there's no money in that, therefore we're going to focus our research because this is how we
are. I see. So you're saying that it's biased what there is research on and what there's not research on.
I think that is a solid argument for weakening how much we rely on the evidence that comes out, because there is a pre-selection of what gets researched in the first place.
I think that's something to consider for sure, but it doesn't negate the value of the evidence. So I think what it does is it goes back to the discussion on how do we use evidence in our clinical decision-making process, and understanding that a lack of evidence is not the same as an evidence of no effect.
Oh, absolutely. Right? No, I agree with that. I'm not suggesting that what gets published, I mean, obviously we can look at any single trial and we can find errors and challenges and things like that. But that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is what never makes it to trial and what, for biased reasons, does make it to trial.
So you're suggesting there are better treatments out there, they just haven't been studied yet.
I'm suggesting there might be, but I'm not trying to go down that conspiracy theory. Really what I'm suggesting is people research the things that are likely to further their careers or bring them income. Therefore, they're more likely to choose those things.
So Chris, this is where the role of, you know, those case studies that I was talking about and the opinion papers that are published as well, that's where they come in, because if you have clinical experience with something, you say, hey, here's something that I've found works, and I can give you a case or even a series of cases, which would be better, that could then set the stage for future research. But it has to be there in the first place.
Yep, it does. You're right. And it's not to say that there aren't, you know, lots of people publishing case reports and case series and things like that. And that may become good research, but there are biases in what gets researched. There are.
You're right.
There are biases in what gets published, remember. Now, here's a question. Why do I have to pay for access to research, Mike?
Well, because you're a sucker, Chris.
Well, no, I mean, I know there are sites I can download it for free, but, and this came up tonight when I was looking, I was doing some research for tonight's show, all of the articles I wanted, the first three, not all of them, the first three articles that I wanted only gave me an abstract. I had to pay for the full text.
Yep, that's definitely an issue that needs to be dealt with. I am definitely pro researches for the masses and should be freely accessible to everybody.
But what that tells us right away is that it isn't, and therefore there's bias. The places that publish research are making money, and therefore they have an incentive, just like a television program has an incentive to sell programs that sell advertisements, there's an incentive to publish what sells.
So that's why we don't, in clinical practice, we don't really rely on individual studies very much, because that in itself could be quite biased. That's why we look to things like systematic reviews and meta-analyses to help guide us, because what that does is that looks at the breadth of all the research that is out there, not just an individual study coming from an individual set of researchers. We're looking at all the people who are looking into an issue and a problem and trying to say what is the evidence on it.
But the same bias still exists, right? Like if there have already been 8 papers published on something, you can say, here's a hot topic, therefore let's do a meta-analysis on this topic. 2 of the 3 papers I looked at were review papers. Mm-hmm. And they were not freely accessible. And it listed how many people had cited them. It had all that information that went with them. But if I wanted access, I had to pay. If I have to pay, the publishing company has an incentive to publish what sells. That means the people that research that want to get published by that company have an incentive to sell them what they want to sell. That means they select research based on that.
If you're a doctor and you look at a review or a meta-analysis and you think it's so profound that you just have to have it and you're willing to pay the ridiculous amounts that they charge for these things, then I think the publisher has an incentive to publish really good quality reviews and meta-analyses that doctors are willing to pay for. That's why we have places like the Cochrane, what do they call it? The Cochrane review. Library.
Yeah.
That put these things together, and those you can access.
But they don't have an incentive to publish quality. They have an incentive to publish what sells. And therefore, researchers have an incentive to research what sells. And I'm not saying that that's always a bad thing. I don't think there's much strain of evil in here, but what I am saying is it means there is inherent bias in research in terms of what gets done and what gets published. And if that's all we're using to develop some of these evidence-based guidelines, then there's a fault there.
You're right. That would be a fault. Fortunately, that's not all we're using, and evidence includes a lot more than just the research.
But this brings it back to my original point. When you take a group, you take a committee of people, and we know this, even though this shouldn't be true, we know this, many of them will not be successful practitioners. That's why they're on a committee, which means what are they relying on? They're relying on the evidence, the research that is in front of them. This meta-analysis of 3,000 patients said this works for this. Therefore, these are now the guidelines for the medical association, and this is what they are supposed to follow.
I think much more often what you see is career practitioners who, you know, at their end of their, okay, I've been a doctor for 40 years and now I don't want to fully retire, and somebody's going to pay me quite a bit of money to sit in a think tank, Chris.
I love think tanks. You know that. You just took.
I know you do, and I'm sure you will be one of those people who help set guidelines at some point, and that doesn't mean that you're a struggling clinician who couldn't make it. What it means is that you have plenty of expertise and people regard you in the industry well enough that they're willing to take your opinion. And as a group, as a committee, you can sit there and look at the evidence and combine that with all of your years of knowledge and say, what are our recommendations in setting these guidelines?
Can we?
And in fact, there's tons and tons of evidence to suggest that many, if not, dare I say, most of the clinical practice guidelines are not really evidence-based. They're more opinion-based.
Well, that just weakens your own argument, I think, Mike.
It doesn't weaken my argument. It strengthens my argument, which is to say, we should be doing more of this. It should be more evidence-based and less opinion-based.
We can't rely, and this is it, right? We can't rely on those committees to make the best choices, and this is the challenge with best practice guidelines. And it's
what they're doing is they're making guidelines again for the general public, right? Not for the individual. It's then the job of the healthcare practitioner to take that and use it on the individual basis, and that's a real challenge.
It is, but again, I have to come back to this again. I think you're talking in theory and not in practice.
I'm talking practice, Chris, because that's what I do. That's what I do.
I'm talking about you and I a little bit less because we don't have best practices in naturopathic medicine. And I want to get into this, actually. We're going to take a break in a minute. I want to get into this when we come back, the role of should we have them in naturopathic medicine. But I'm talking about conventional medicine, and they have tons of best practices, and it is difficult for practitioners to stray from those guidelines.
Okay. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. I don't think that's necessarily true, but sure.
Okay. We'll be right back. All right. Welcome back to the Health Happens podcast. I hope you're enjoying our debate tonight. I think we're enjoying our debate tonight. Are we, Mike?
I'm having a good time.
Yeah. I'm having a good time too. Yeah. No, I think this has actually been kind of fun.
It is. It's a fun discussion because it's something that we both, I mean, I think we sit a little bit on both sides of the fence. It's probably more on one side of the fence on this topic, but it is interesting to get into the nitty gritty of it and discuss the devil's advocate point of view too, right?
You know, actually, Mike, I'm going to add this personal bit to it. I don't know if you know.
Let's do it.
Yeah, you probably know. For 6 years now, I've taught a particular cohort. I teach quite a bit at the naturopathic school, and we have a specialized program for doctors, for medical doctors. Most of them are international. All of them are internationally trained. Some of them are from here, but trained somewhere else. But so I've been doing that for about 6 years. And every year, all six of the years, so we have a course that is not one of the courses I teach that they take. And it's about evidence-based medicine. And they make the students go through research and review best practices. And they basically say, there's not enough evidence to support us doing this, and therefore you should be following these best practices, which are usually more conventional. And every year they come to me, and I don't know why they come to me, but they come to me and they say, they're outraged. And they say, this is not why I left medicine. The problem with medicine is it has its blinders on when it looks at the value of research, the value of evidence, and how only certain things make it there. So a lot of what I've been saying tonight, but to hear this for 6 years in a row from a group of medical doctors who say we're blinkered by our over-reliance on research and evidence, and here's the thing, the evidence, it doesn't check out when we put it into practice.
Okay, so, I mean, there's a lot to digest there, Chris. I think, again, you're trying to equate evidence and research, and they're not exclusively the same thing. Evidence can mean a lot of different things, and research is one of the forms of evidence that we rely on. Perhaps the main form of evidence, for sure, but it's not the only form by any stretch of the imagination. There's a lot of debate going on. Not a lot of debate. There's definitely some debate going on, especially at like the public health level, on deciding what should help drive our recommendations and essentially, you know, the guidelines that we were talking about before, what constitutes best practice, and research makes up a big part of that. But more and more, I think people are pushing back and saying that's not what evidence is. Evidence is not just research. Evidence is a combination of research, of clinical experience, of feedback from patients, from what we see as well. It's not just, don't put all the focus on what's seen in randomized controlled trials, because you're absolutely right, that doesn't translate very well into what you're seeing on a daily situation. People are much more complex than that. Controlled trials are controlled. They're trying to eliminate confounders and all the other factors that are going on, and you just don't see that in regular day-to-day life, right?
Confounding factors.
Yeah. So it's important to for a good clinician to be able to integrate all those things in the decision-making process. Yes, it is important to, you know, break it down to the lowest level and look at our CTs and, you know, say, is this particular treatment better than a placebo, better than doing nothing? Yes, it is. Or even a head-to-head trial. Is this treatment better than that treatment? All other things being equal, and then you move forward from there. And that does help us to guide that decision-making process. So it's not meant to be the be-all and end-all of evidence-based medicine.
So it almost sounds like you're backpedaling a little bit because...
I'm not at all. I'm just trying to put it in context, and I'm trying to, maybe backpedal on some of the things that you've tried to push and just redefine what is evidence-based practice.
But I think
evidence does include more than just research.
But I think you're stretching it for your convenience.
No, I'm not. I mean, this is really what people are talking about in the real world at the policy level.
But beyond research, isn't all the rest of evidence opinion?
It's... No, I mean...
Because then if that's the case, we're talking about opinion-informed plus research.
We're not talking about opinion. Opinion and experience are not the same thing, Chris, because opinion is I have nothing to back up what I think. These are my beliefs.
Emotional statements.
Emotional or even your own biases, right? So, and that's what I was saying earlier about a given single clinical experience on its own is... chock full of confounding variables and bias and all sorts of other things. And that's why it's important to bring that to the community so it can be observed and debated to remove some of those biases, hopefully from a objective third party or a collective community.
Okay, no, I hear what you're saying, but what if it's not research, how do you qualify the rest of that information? I mean, it still sounds like it's very subjective in how it's actually worked out by a practitioner.
Oh, absolutely is.
And if that's the case, then it's riddled with bias.
It will be at the individual level. Of course, it will be, and that's not a bad thing.
Well, I mean, I'm not necessarily suggesting. Well, I mean, you know, I'm arguing against some of this topic in general, but it sounds to me like you're stretching the definition of evidence to include inherently biased subjective material, which, if I'm not mistaken, evidence-based medicine is trying distinctly to walk us away from.
No, evidence-based medicine is trying to walk us away from just doing things the way we've always done it. Just because that's the way we've always done it, and that's the way we were taught to do it. Evidence-based medicine should be fluid. What is evidence-based best practice today is not necessarily going to be the same 10 years from now, right?
Course,
so
sure.
It has to be able to change over time.
But how do we change that if we're not using research as our primary tool to leverage?
We probably are using it as our primary tool, Chris. We are,
but I
not
think
the only
already,
tool.
I think we've
not
already
the
established
it's,
the flaws.
It's part
there.
Of that equation. Right? So it's this plus this plus this plus this. And, you know, it is more heavily weighted towards research than the other components of it. Absolutely. But that's not wrong. It's just understanding that in real life settings, you have to consider the other variables that research aims to eliminate.
So what has more value then, research or biased subjective opinion?
Research.
Okay. So... if that's the case, how do you keep those two things wed together? Because aren't they often at odds?
I mean, they can be at odds sometimes, right?
So what do we do then?
Well, then that's where you have to use your own clinical judgment, right? But including the evidence in that, including research and all the other components that make up evidence in that decision-making process is your job as a clinician.
I agree with that. Absolutely, I agree with that. But I do. I feel like you're altering the definition because I feel like evidence-based medicine means you should be calculating things like likelihood ratios, and you should be using not just what are best practices, but what the research dictates is the best way to do it, even if it goes against your clinical judgment and reasoning.
No,
if your patient has diabetes, these are the rules you should follow.
No, I think best practices and saying these are the rules you should follow for every person who comes in your door are two entirely different things. And if that's the way a doctor is practicing, you know, I mean, that's cookbook medicine, and that's not.
But Mike, isn't that family medicine? I mean, isn't most family medicine
so many
algorithm?
Family doctors are just so angry at you right now, Chris, saying that's totally unfair.
But, I mean, let's be frank here, though. If you go to your family doctor and you say three phrases, you trigger an algorithm that automatically activates until you exit by by a certain set of tests that rule in or rule out.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not how an algorithm works?
Sure.
And is an algorithm not effectively cookbook medicine?
No, it's a decision-making process. There's got to be flexibility in there.
But there's not. I mean, you can look up the algorithm for just about every condition. If this, do this. If negative, do this. There's an algorithm for almost every condition.
Sure. But again, there's room for other inputs that are not present in the research is what
there?
I'm trying to say. Yeah, absolutely. If you have a patient and you know that they're taking X amount of medications, you might have to adjust and move away from the best practice.
Oh, no, but that's built in. That's built into the algorithm.
This is what I'm saying. It's built into the algorithm, and that allows personalization. But that's, again, you might be moving away from what is your quote-unquote best practice. That doesn't mean it's not evidence-based medicine anymore. It still is evidence-based medicine. You just have to, you know, be a little artful in there, Chris.
But I think I'm challenging the word artful in that it's, I mean, you've seen these algorithms, right? Like they exist. We've seen them. And it's, if your patient has this co-condition or is taking this medication, then you exit this algorithm and you enter into the next one. It's quite formulaic in how it's done.
Yep.
And so,
and that helps you come to, you know, maybe the best number one treatment option for generally speaking, like on average, this would be the best for the most people, but it doesn't take into account everybody. It doesn't take into account the person who's sitting in your office, Chris. You have to consider all of those things. You have to consider their personal preferences, their past experiences. You have to consider everything, right? Cost.
Oh, no, listen, hey, I mean, this is kind of the argument that I'm suggesting is evidence-based medicine is strongly rooted in algorithmic functions that determine what must be done for a patient and therefore to the detriment of a practitioner's skill and preference.
Really?
I think that's kind of what, I mean.
Why is that to the detriment of a practitioner's skill and practice?
Well, it effectively, I mean, this is the idea, you know, you've heard this as well, that the frontline doctors, like family doctors and naturopathic doctors, we could probably be replaced by AI, and it would probably do a better job of outcomes. That's evidence-based, is it?
Sure. And you know what? I mean, it's a topic for another day, but as far as like diagnosis goes, AI has some pretty promising stuff coming down the pipeline.
Yeah, it's true. Medicine is definitely, to step out of my character for a second, medicine definitely has some exciting, if you're not a medical practitioner, some exciting things that are probably on the horizon.
Well, I mean, to help guide us, for sure. Like, there are some algorithms out there that can, you know, predict things like schizophrenia way before we can diagnose it.
Yeah, Alzheimer's. I mean, really, there's no limit to all of the diseases that an algorithm, not an algorithm, but an AI or AI-based algorithm.
Which are based on algorithms, of course.
I think it goes deeper than that, but
They're learning themselves in ways that we don't even understand.
That's smarter than us. I want to get back into character, but I think that you're right. There are some...
Good. Let's just leave it at that then, Chris.
I think you're right about AI and some of what it'll do. But I don't know. I mean, this is where... Is that where we want to go? Here's where I can come back and talk about evidence-based medicine. Is that where we want to go?
Sorry, we went off on too many tangents there.
If frontline medical practitioners, doctors, nurses, NDs, like all of us that work with people day to day with their most common things, if we're effectively replaceable, should we be replaced? And do we, like so many other things, do we say, all right, research, evidence, enough is enough. We want to maintain it this way. We want to say, no, let's have us still meet with humans.
Is that what it sounded like I said, Chris?
To me,
I didn't mean it that way, if it did sound that way.
It sounded like that, I'm sure, to our listeners, Mike.
I don't think it did.
No. Okay.
So, no, definitively, no, that's not what I'm suggesting at all.
I think one of our best points so far, though, is saying if we're using your broad definition of evidence, it sounds like the larger weight of what is being done is still subjective opinion.
It is subjective, of course. Of course it is. But, it's not entirely subjective. It's still based on certain facts that we know, certain experiences.
And degree should it be based on the research, Mike?
I would say, I don't know, you're going to ask pin me down and then tear me apart for it. But, I don't know, 60%?
60%, okay.
Sure. Arbitrarily.
Arbitrary. So evidence-based medicine is 60% research and 40% totally
everything
biased
else.
Subjective opinion.
Not totally biased,
sure,
Chris.
Every individual has at least the possibility of being totally biased. So if we account for individual
bias. Not totally biased.
Sure, why not? I could be 100% biased. I could say
you
I don't
could. Know. That would make you a bad practitioner.
You're right, but we have to account for that possibility.
Okay.
Because I'm sure. Sure. So 60% should be research and 40% I'm allowed to do whatever I want?
No.
Is that what you're 40% suggesting?
Everything else is based on your own clinical knowledge and experience and expertise that's outside of what is, you know, in the research as well as what the patient feedback is.
So 40% of the time, I can discount research.
No, not 40% of the time. 40% of the weight of your decision.
Ah, okay. So in that case, if we use the standard majority, I should always go with what the research says.
No.
If I'm weighting it and 60%
well, on average,
on
you probably will end up there most of the time because that's the best recommendation for most of the people most of the time.
Okay. Mike, I want to introduce another topic. Can I try it?
Go.
Should naturopathic medicine have best practice guidelines?
I don't think it's a bad thing.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's a bad thing.
And what do you think we'll do with them?
Honestly, most of the time, toss them out the window.
Yeah, I think we'll roll up a bunch of like mullein and vervain and smoke them.
Well, I don't know about that. But I do think that it's not that easy, especially when you're dealing with any alternative medicines. You know, you got naturopathic medicine or chiropractic or whatever.
TCM has them.
Sure. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that everybody gets the exact same thing all the time in TCM, right?
I mean, pretty close. If you meet the criteria for a diagnosis, you get a fairly limited number of treatment options. It's not
so you have to give acupuncture in this situation,
or more. It's more likely herbal combos. But there are. It's sort of like if you have these conditions, you take these different formulas, and it's a if this is present, do this, and if this is present, do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there is quite an element of that actually in TCM. So I don't think it's out of the range of possibilities that it could be done for naturopathic medicine. And I can tell you this, a lot of people are talking about it right now.
Sure. And like I said, I don't think it's inherently a bad thing to have guidelines. Guidelines are not bad. Guidelines don't say you have to do this. Guidelines say, you know, this is what tends to work the best in most of these cases. And that's not a bad thing.
What if I love homeopathy, which will definitely not be in the guidelines anywhere? What do I do with that?
I don't know what to do with that, Chris. I don't think I'm equipped to answer that question.
I don't think you've been equipped for this whole discussion, Mike. Oh, you don't have anything to say to that? Come on. The banter is only fun if you play back and forth. I don't want to actually hurt your feelings.
I know. That's why I didn't play back into it.
Don't want to.
I just made you sound like a jerk.
I don't want to break you as a person. Save that for social events.
So do you want to talk about guidelines in naturopathic medicine a little bit more, and what would they look like?
I wanted to get them. I think that should be an independent topic, and I think we should probably include that as a debate.
Okay, but
topic.
Since we're here, we might as well discuss it a little bit. Yeah. And if there were to be guidelines, what should go into building those guidelines?
You know, I almost want to preemptively say this. You know what? Maybe this serves as a good template to what we are talking about tonight. There's no way you could get consensus
correct
from at least NDs as I understand them as to what would constitute best practices for any condition. I just don't think it would be possible. Here's what's interesting about that. If you can't get consensus from everybody, then you ask for volunteers to join committees and groups, but probably what you do is there's some selection bias there, and eventually you form a committee of people who have time, and they develop guidelines that will not widely be accepted by many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the most likely outcome.
How should they be done? Well, I mean, I'd have to step out of character here, and I would say we would have to look at research, but I think we would have to go a lot broader in this case because there's a lot less research on a lot of the things that we do. And some of the things that we think are pretty good, there's very little research.
Do you think if there's something that has no research, it could have any place in the guidelines?
That's a very good question, Mike. And that's kind of like saying, do you think a GP should be allowed to prescribe homeopathy? If there's no evidence of harm, there's no reason that it can't be prescribed alongside other treatments that are effective.
Okay. I mean, that's really stretching the definition of a guideline then.
Well, I mean, a guideline guides you to what's best practice. It doesn't preclude you from doing other things, provided they don't cause harm.
Okay.
Like, if you look at the diabetes guidelines, it doesn't say, and don't give your patient chromium and cinnamon.
Sure.
It says, but you have to make sure you give them metformin at this stage and, you know, the progression mm-hmm. as you go from there. So I think the best practice guidelines for naturopathic medicine could say, if your patient has type 2 diabetes, you should be giving them goat's rue and cinnamon because the evidence suggests that these are effective. If you want to give them a homeopathic, that's just off the books. You can do whatever you want because it doesn't cause harm. We think it probably won't do any good, but it's okay if you want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's probably what would end up happening. And I think it could have some use.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. I think that's fine. And, you know, having that guideline for quick decision-making, especially for those less experienced practitioners, that can be really, really useful.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've actually developed something that I use with my students where it's acute prescribing guidelines for, you know, pretty much now we're up to, I don't know, probably 30-plus conditions.
And I bet they're based partially at least on research.
No, they're based exclusively on what I have to say on those topics.
Yeah, I just don't believe that at all.
Well, you know, you're right. The crazy thing is they could be, but, and this I talk about quite a bit, responsible teaching means they aren't. I do sometimes say, in fact, I often will say, and I do this when I teach as well, here's something that I find helpful, but I always say it with that triple star that says, this is just opinion. And here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here's what I think. Do what you want with that last bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. You said something very interesting. You said responsible teaching means that they aren't. And I mean, if that's the case for teaching, don't you think you owe at least that to your patients?
Well, personally, Mike, I think you know that I do.
Yeah.
But I've been playing the other side tonight, and I could very easily say, no, I don't owe anything to my patients. I owe only, in terms of obligation to look at the research, I owe to them only to do what I feel is the very best thing to do for them, and that does not have to include what you are defining as evidence.
Interesting. If you were my doctor, I would certainly question that and say, how did you come to this conclusion that this
came
is the best?
Came to me in a dream, Mike.
All right.
Hey, why not?
There you have it.
But you could say that. I mean, there are practitioners that do that. But I mean, you could also say this. You could say a lot of the same arguments that we've made tonight. You could say, look, I know there's research out there for this. There's also research out there against this. There's research out there for everything. No matter what you want it to say, you can find it.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I don't spend a lot of time reviewing the research. I go with what works in clinical practice, and these are the things that I have seen work. That is not evidence-informed medicine. That is me doing what I think is best.
I think that absolutely is evidence-informed.
Yeah, I know, and this is where I think our debate's almost breaking down because we're losing a little bit on the definition there.
Yeah.
Because okay. I could be, in what I think is best, it could be so colored by so many things in my life. I could think the color red is best, so I only prescribe red things.
Yeah.
And I could probably find enough red things that are beneficial to draw the conclusion that red things are good. You know, some people say this in Chinese medicine, black things are good for the kidneys. I don't think there's, you know, black beans are kind of good for the kidneys, but I don't think we could support that with real evidence.
But yeah, not because they're black.
Exactly. But I could think that, and I could say that, and I'd even be right sometimes.
Yeah, and honestly, as long as the evidence supports it, who cares why you came to that decision?
But that's, I mean, thinking that black things are good for the kidneys is not evidence-based medicine.
It's not evidence-based medicine, but thinking that black beans are good for the kidneys and having evidence to back it up and then recommending them is.
Yes.
And that's good.
But suggesting that other black things are because black beans are good is
sure. So this is where we get to, okay, what informs that decision-making process?
Well, I mean, this is the suggestion that a totally biased piece of information that I'm holding on to is all I'm using to inform my decisions.
Right.
And that's
bad.
Well, yeah, that's bad medicine. I agree with that. But there's nothing stopping me from doing that. And there's nothing stopping me from saying that that's okay if I'm getting results.
Sure.
And so I don't need evidence-informed medicine at all. I can just say, well, black things are good for the kidneys, and most of my patients are getting better. Therefore, the evidence suggests black things are good for the kidneys.
Yeah, and you know what? Some people might follow that if that got published and people started investigating and determining, you know, what's really going on there and then having a reason to make that same decision or not.
Sure. Okay. All right. Before we start going, because I think we'll go in a circle from here, anything else we want to add to this debate?
Anything else we want to add to it? I think we've pretty much summed up the big points there, Chris.
Yeah, I would agree with it. And hopefully our listeners have taken some useful bits away from this and maybe deciding...
Well, at least given some perspective and thought.
Some thought and counter-thought out there.
Yes. Do you have anything you want to say to wrap it up?
No, I mean, I think I've been kind of clear throughout, you know, the side that I'm taking and how I feel about it. I do believe evidence definitely plays a role in determining our clinical decisions. And I also believe it's important when the evidence strongly goes against something you've been doing, something I've been doing, any of us have been doing, it's important to at least consider that, and you know, we see this, oh boy, Mike, do we ever see this in naturopathic medicine where evidence emerges that suggests a therapy or something really doesn't do a lot of good, and yet we persist.
Well, why do you persist? Are you seeing results?
Well, sure you are. But are you seeing results because the thing is black, or are you seeing results for something else? And that's where, I mean, we've got major problems there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, and that's fine. But I think... You know, to use something in the face of evidence to the contrary is, oh boy, I don't even know what the word is for it.
Well, that's, I mean, it's irresponsible.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's the word for it. I mean, it's irresponsible. There's almost no way to get around it. If you are using something that suggests it has no effect, and let's say the research piles up and it looks increasingly clear that it has no effect, and you're using that and therefore not using something else that does show effect, that's irresponsible medicine.
And that's harmful.
I agree. So that's kind of where I stand on. I think it's important to know the evidence and be up to speed. But I do fundamentally actually agree, and I think you and I generally agree on this overall. I think it's important to be evidence informed, but not evidence attached.
Oh, yeah. I definitely would agree with that as well. It's not the be-all and end-all. There is individual differences. There's absolutely circumstances where, you know, the evidence said something for a long time, and then we've discovered, oh, that's actually not true. And, you know, there's obviously circumstances, too, where really good recommendations are not backed by evidence. I mean, you know, most surgical interventions, there's no evidence out there that stitches are good for big lacerations. You know, they've never done randomized control trials for that, but it is.
So I'm not clear. So I should or shouldn't get stitches?
No, getting stitches if you're still bleeding is a good idea, right? But again, just because there isn't evidence for something doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a good practice for sure. But paying attention to the evidence and keeping up with the evidence is, I think, a best practice as well, because it allows us to be fluid and allow our practices and our recommendations to continue to evolve as the research evolves.
All right. Hot topic tonight. If you enjoyed what we got into, send us an email or a question or just a comment. We'd love to hear what you thought about tonight's show. And especially if you had a point where you're like, oh, you should have said this, Chris. This would have totally broken them even further. Those are good. Those are good ideas for us to share and talk about on air. So while you're there, give us a rating and tell your friends. Otherwise, it's always a pleasure having you with us on the Health Happens podcast.
See you next time.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.